The Shadow Out of Time by H.P. Lovecraft, Part 6. I come now to the crucial and most difficult part of my narrative, all the more difficult because I cannot be quite certain of its reality. At times I feel uncomfortably sure that I was not dreaming or deluded, and it is this feeling, in view of the stupendous implications which the objective truth of my experience would raise, which impels me to make this record. My son, a trained psychologist with the fullest and most sympathetic knowledge of my whole case, shall be the primary judge of what I have to tell. First, let me outline the externals of the matter, as those at the camp know them. On the night of July 17, 18, after a windy day, I retired early but could not sleep. Rising shortly before 11, and afflicted as usual with that strange feeling regarding the northeastward terrain, I set out on one of my nocturnal walks. Seeing and greeting only one person, an Australian miner named Tupper, as I left our precinct. The moon, slightly past full, shone from a clear sky and drenched the ancient sands with a white, leprous radiance which seemed to me somehow infinitely evil. There was no longer any wind, nor did any return for nearly 5 hours, as amply attested by Tupper and the others who did not sleep through the night. The Australian last saw me walking rapidly across the pallid, secret-guarding hillocks towards the northeast. About 3:30 a.m., a violent wind blew up, waking everyone in camp and felling 3 of the tents. The sky was unclouded, and the desert still blazed with that leprous moonlight. As the party saw to the tents, my absence was noted, but in view of my previous walks, this circumstance gave no one alarm. And yet, as many as 3 men, all Australian, seemed to feel something sinister in the air. Mackenzie explained to Professor Freeborn that this was a fear picked up from blackfellow folklore, the natives having woven a curious fabric of malignant myth about the high winds which at long intervals sweep across the sands under a clear sky. Such winds, it is whispered, blow out of the great stone huts under the ground where terrible things have happened, and are never felt except near places where the big marked stones are scattered. Close to 4, the gale subsided as suddenly as it had begun, leaving the sand hills in new and unfamiliar shapes. It was just past 5, with the bloated, fungoid moon sinking in the west when I staggered into camp, hatless, tattered, features scratched and ensanguined, and without my electric torch. Most of the men had returned to bed, but Professor Dyer was smoking a pipe in front of his tent. Seeing my winded and almost frenzied state, he called Dr. Boyle, and the two of them got me on my cot and made me comfortable. My son, roused by the stir, soon joined them, and they all tried to force me to lie still and attempt sleep. But there was no sleep for me. My psychological state was very extraordinary, different from anything I had previously suffered. After a time, I insisted upon talking, nervously and elaborately explaining my condition. I told them I had become fatigued and had lain down in the sand for a nap. There had, I said, been dreams even more frightful than usual, and when I was awaked by a sudden high wind, my overwrought nerves had snapped. I had fled in panic, frequently falling over half-buried stones and thus gaining my tattered and bedraggled aspect. I must have slept long, hence the hours of my absence. Of anything strange, either seen or experienced, I hinted absolutely nothing, exercising the greatest self-control in that respect. But I spoke of a change of mind regarding the whole work of the expedition and earnestly urged a halt in all digging toward the northeast. My reasoning was patently weak, for I mentioned a dearth of blocks, a wish not to offend the superstitious miners, a possible shortage of funds from the college, and other things either untrue or irrelevant. Naturally, no one paid the least attention to my new wishes, not even my son, whose concern for my health was very obvious. The next day I was up and around the camp, but took no part in the excavations. Seeing that I could not stop the work, I decided to return home as soon as possible for the sake of my nerves, and made my son promise to fly me in the plane to Perth, 1,000 miles to the southwest, as soon as he had surveyed the region I wished let alone. If, I reflected, the thing I had seen was still visible, I might decide to attempt a specific warning, even at the cost of ridicule. It was just conceivable that the miners who knew the local folklore might back me up. Humoring me, my son made the survey that very afternoon, flying over all the terrain my walk could possibly have covered. Yet nothing of what I had found remained in sight. It was the case of the anomalous basalt block all over again. The shifting sand had wiped out every trace. For an instant I half regretted having lost a certain awesome object in my stark fright. But now I know that the loss was merciful. I can still believe my whole experience was an illusion, especially if, as I devoutly hope, that hellish abyss is never found. Wingate took me to Perth July 20, though declining to abandon the expedition and return home. He stayed with me until the 25th, when the steamer for Liverpool sailed. Now, in the cabin of the Empress, I'm pondering long and frantically on the entire matter, and have decided that my son, at least, must be informed. It shall rest with him whether to diffuse the matter more widely. In order to meet any eventuality, I've prepared this summary of my background, as already known in a scattered way to others, and will now tell as briefly as possible what seemed to happen during my absence from the camp that hideous night. Nerves on edge and whipped into a kind of perverse eagerness by that inexplicable, dread-mingled, pseudo-mnemonic urge toward the northeast, I plodded on beneath the evil burning moon. Here and there I saw, half shrouded by the sand, those primal cyclopean blocks left from nameless and forgotten eons. The incalculable age and brooding horror of this monstrous waste began to oppress me as never before, and I could not keep from thinking of my maddening dreams. Of the frightful legends which lay behind them, and of the present fears of natives and miners concerning the desert and its carven stones. And yet I plodded on as if to some eldritch rendezvous, more and more assailed by bewildering fancies, compulsions, and pseudo-memories. I thought of some of the possible contours of the lines of stones as seen by my son from the air, and wondered why they seemed at once so ominous and so familiar. Something was fumbling and rattling at the latch of my recollection, while another unknown force sought to keep the portal barred. The night was windless, and the pallid sand curved upward and downward like frozen waves of the sea. I had no goal, but somehow plowed along as if with fate-bound assurance. My dreams welled up into the waking world, so that each sand-embedded megalith seemed part of endless rooms and corridors of prehuman masonry, carved and hieroglyphed with symbols that I knew too well from years of custom as a captive mind of the great race. At moments I fancied I saw those omniscient conical horrors moving about at their accustomed tasks, and I feared to look down lest I find myself one with them in aspect. Yet all the while I saw the sand-covered blocks as well as the rooms and corridors, the evil burning moon as well as the lamps of luminous crystal, the endless desert as well as the waving ferns and cycads beyond the windows. I was awake and dreaming at the same time. I do not know how long or how far, or indeed in just what direction, I had walked when I first spied the heap of blocks, bared by the day's wind. It was the largest group in one place that I had so far seen, and so sharply did it impress me that the visions of fabulous eons faded suddenly away. Again there were only the desert and the evil moon and the shards of an unguessed past. I drew close and paused and cast the added light of my electric torch over the tumbled pile. A hillock had blown away, leaving a low, irregularly round mass of megaliths and smaller fragments, some 40 feet across and from 2 to 8 feet high. From the very outset I realized that there was some utterly unprecedented quality about these stones. Not only was the mere number of them quite without parallel, but something in the sand-worn traces of design arrested me as I scanned them under the mingled beams of the moon and my torch. Not that any one differed essentially from the earlier specimens we had found. It was something subtler than that. The impression did not come when I looked at one block alone, but only when I ran my eye over several almost simultaneously. Then, at last, the truth dawned upon me. The curvilinear patterns on many of these blocks were closely related, parts of one vast decorative conception. For the first time in this eon-shaken waste, I had come upon a mass of masonry in its old position, tumbled and fragmentary, it is true, but nonetheless existing in a very definite sense. Mounting at a low place, I clambered laboriously over the heap, here and there clearing away the sand with my fingers and constantly striving to interpret varieties of size, shape, and style, and relationships of design. After a while, I could vaguely guess at the nature of the bygone structure and at the designs which had once stretched over the vast surfaces of the primal masonry. The perfect identity of the whole, with some of my dream glimpses, appalled and unnerved me. This was once a cyclopean corridor, 30 feet tall, paved with octagonal blocks and solidly vaulted overhead. There would have been rooms opening off on the right, and at the farther end one of those strange inclined planes would have wound down to still lower depths. I started violently as these conceptions occurred to me, for there was more in them than the blocks themselves had supplied. How did I know that this level should have been far underground? How did I know that the plane leading upward should have been behind me? How did I know that the long subterranean passage to the square of pillars ought to lie on the left, one level above me? How did I know that the room of machines and the rightward leading tunnel to the central archives ought to lie two levels below? How did I know that there would be one of those horrible metal-banded trapdoors at the very bottom, four levels down? Bewildered by this intrusion from the dream world, I found myself shaking and bathed in a cold perspiration. Then, as a last intolerable touch, I felt that faint, insidious stream of cool air trickling up from a depressed place near the center of the huge heap. Instantly, as once before, my visions faded, and I saw again only the evil moonlight, the brooding desert, and the spreading tumulus of Paleogean masonry, something real and tangible, yet fraught with infinite suggestions of nighted mystery now confronted me. For that stream of air could argue but one thing, a hidden gulf of great size beneath the disordered blocks on the surface. My first thought was of the sinister blackfellow legends of vast underground huts among the megaliths where horrors happen and great winds are born. Then thoughts of my own dreams came back, and I felt dim pseudo-memories tugging at my mind. What manner of place lay below me? What primal, inconceivable source of age-old myth cycles and haunting nightmares might I be on the brink of uncovering? It was only for a moment that I hesitated. Far more than curiosity and scientific zeal was driving me on and working against my growing fear. I seemed to move almost automatically, as if in the clutch of some compelling fate. Pocketing my torch and struggling with a strength that I had not thought I possessed, I wrenched aside first one titan fragment of stone, and then another, till there welled up a strong draught whose dampness contrasted oddly with the desert's dry air. A black rift began to yawn, and at length, when I had pushed away every fragment small enough to budge, the leprous moonlight blazed on an aperture of ample width to admit me. I drew out my torch and cast a brilliant beam into the opening. Below me was a chaos of tumbled masonry, sloping roughly down toward the north end at an angle of about 45 degrees, and evidently the result of some bygone collapse from above. Between its surface and the ground level was a gulf of impenetrable blackness, at whose upper edge were signs of gigantic, stress-heaved vaulting. At this point, it appeared, the desert sands lay directly upon a floor of some titan structure of Earth's youth. How preserved through eons of geologic convulsion I could not then and cannot now even attempt to guess. In retrospect, the barest idea of a sudden, lone descent into such a doubtful abyss, and at a time when one's whereabouts were unknown to any living soul, seems like the utter apex of insanity. Perhaps it was. Yet that night I embarked without hesitation upon such a descent. Again there was manifest that lure and driving of fatality which had all along seemed to direct my course. With torch flashing intermittently to save the battery, I commenced a mad scramble down the sinister cyclopean incline before the opening, sometimes facing downward as I found good hand and footholds, and at other times turning to face the heap of megalith as I clung and fumbled more precariously. In two directions beside me, distant walls of carven, crumbled masonry loomed dimly under the direct beams of my torch. Ahead, however, was only unbroken blackness. I kept no track of time during my downward scramble. So seething with baffling hints and images was my mind that all objective matters seemed withdrawn into incalculable distances. Physical sensation was dead, and even fear remained as a wraith-like, inactive gargoyle leering impotently at me. Eventually I reached a level floor strewn with fallen blocks, shapeless fragments of stone, and sand and detritus of every kind. On either side, perhaps 30 feet apart, rose massive walls culminating in huge groinings. That they were carved I could just discern, but the nature of the carvings was beyond my perception. What held me the most was the vaulting overhead. The beam from my torch could not reach the roof, but the lower parts of the monstrous arches stood out distinctly, and so perfect was their identity with what I had seen in countless dreams of the elder world that I trembled actively for the first time. Behind and high above, a faint luminous blur told of the distant moonlit world outside. Some vague shred of caution warned me that I should not let it out of my sight, lest I have no guide for my return. I now advanced toward the wall on my left, where the traces of carving were plainest. The littered floor was nearly as hard to traverse as the downward heap had been, but I managed to pick my difficult way. At one place, I heaved aside some blocks and kicked away the detritus to see what the pavement was like, and shuddered at the utter, fateful familiarity of the great octagonal stones whose buckled surface still held roughly together. Reaching a convenient distance from the wall, I cast the torchlight slowly and carefully over its worn remnants of carving. Some bygone influx of water seemed to have acted on the sandstone surface, while there were curious incrustations which I could not explain. In places, the masonry was very loose and distorted, and I wondered how many eons more this primal, hidden edifice could keep its remaining traces of form amidst Earth's heaving. But it was the carvings themselves that excited me most. Despite their time-crumbled state, they were relatively easy to trace at close range, and the complete, intimate familiarity of every detail almost stunned my imagination. That the major attributes of this hoary masonry should be familiar was not beyond normal credibility. Powerfully impressing the weavers of certain myths, they had become embodied in a stream of cryptic lore which, somehow coming to my notice during the amnesiac period, had evoked vivid images in my subconscious mind. But how could I explain the exact and minute fashion in which each line and spiral of these strange designs tallied with what I had dreamt for more than a score of years? What obscure, forgotten iconography could have reproduced each subtle shading and nuance which so persistently, exactly, and unvaryingly besieged my sleeping vision night after night? For this was no chance or remote resemblance. Definitely and absolutely, the millennially ancient, eon-hidden corridor in which I stood was the original of something I knew in sleep as intimately as I knew my own house in Crane Street, Arkham. True, my dreams showed the place in its undecayed prime, but the identity was no less real on that account. I was wholly and horribly oriented. The particular structure I was in was known to me. Known, too, was its place in that terrible elder city of dreams. That I could visit unerringly any point in that structure or in that city which had escaped the changes and devastations of uncounted age, I realized with hideous and instinctive certainty. What in God's name could all this mean? How would I come to know what I knew? And what awful reality could lie behind those antique tales of the beings who had dwelt in this labyrinth of primordial stone? Words can convey only fractionally the welter of dread and bewilderment which ate at my spirit. I knew this place. I knew what lay before me, and what had lain overhead before the myriad towering stories had fallen to dust and debris in the desert. No need now, I thought with a shudder, to keep that faint blur of moonlight in view. I was torn betwixt a longing to flee and a feverish mixture of burning curiosity and driving fatality. What had happened to this monstrous megalopolis of Eld in the million years since the time of my dreams? Of the subterranean mazes which had underlain the city and linked all its Titan towers, how much had still survived the writhings of Earth's crust? Had I come upon a whole buried world of unholy archaism? Could I still find the house of the Writing Master, and the tower where Shigha, a captive mind from the star-headed vegetable carnivores of Antarctica, had chiseled certain pictures on the blank spaces of the walls? Would the passage at the second level down to the Hall of the Alien Minds still be unchoked and traversable? In that hall, the captive mind of an incredible entity, a half-plastic denizen of the hollow interior of an unknown trans-Plutonian planet 18 million years in the future, had kept a certain thing which it had modeled from clay. I shut my eyes and put my hand to my head in a vain, pitiful attempt to drive these insane dream fragments from my consciousness. Then, for the first time, I felt acutely the coolness, motion, and the dampness of the surrounding air. Shuddering, I realized that a vast chain of eon-dead black gulfs must indeed be yawning somewhere beyond and below me. I thought of the frightful chambers and corridors and inclines as I recalled them from my dreams. Would the way to the central archive still be open? Again, that driving fatality tugged insistently at my brain as I recalled the awesome records that once lay cased in those rectangular vaults of rustless metal. There, said the dreams and legends, had reposed the whole history, past and future, of the cosmic space-time continuum, written by captive minds from every orb and every age in the solar system. Madness, of course, but had I not now stumbled into a nighted world as mad as I? I thought of the locked metal shelves and of the curious knob twistings needed to open each one. My own came vividly into my consciousness. How often had I gone through that intricate routine of varied turns and pressures in the terrestrial vertebrate sections on the lowest level? Every detail was fresh and familiar. If there were such a vault as I had dreamed of, I could open it in a moment. It was then that madness took me utterly. An instant later, and I was leaping and stumbling over the rocky debris toward the well-remembered incline to the depths below. End of part 6.